Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. In 1942, when my mom was 15, she went into hiding, lest she be exterminated. She left her life, her identity, her history behind. What did hiding mean? Well, in her words, it was never go near a window, never talk above a whisper, if talking at all was safe, not walk other than tiptoe, if walking was safe at all, and of course, never go outside unless I had to change hiding places. And all that for 3 years, which must have been unbelievably anguishing for a teenager. I say must have been because my survival mechanism was denial, total and absolute, except for one outburst. My mother was an amazing piece of work. I get my pathological optimism and apocalyptic thinking honestly. I never heard from her about her experience on hiding until I was in my 20s. She had stories she told about herself to us, her kids, stories she told about herself to her friends, and different stories about herself to herself. When I was about 10, my dad and grandmother started to tell stories about my mother and the Holocaust. Although that's probably true for most people, you can imagine all these stories were different and changed over time. When I think stories, I conjure Sue Fantel Spivak, poet, storyteller, teacher, artist, and community activist, who taught creative writing and told traditional and her own tales and oral histories most of her adult life to children's, teens, and community. You can find a link to her poetry chapbook, The Power of Impossible Stories, in the show notes. Sue Spivak, it's so wonderful to see you on the screen, and we're talking, and it's good for my heart and soul to see you and talk to you.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to see you. Because I'm working on telling stories and expecting questions, it's been like getting ready for a storytelling performance, although I have not been practicing any stories. But it was the same, oh my God, how am I going to get it right? And of course, the technology.
Not to worry. The reason I wanted to talk to you is I've been thinking more about storytelling than at any time in my life. And I'm thinking about it not just because I'm podcasting. And so in each episode, I think about what's the story I'm trying to tell in the episode? What are the stories I'm trying to tell in the episode? And then what is the overall story I'm trying to tell by just doing this?
Right.
And not only that, I'm finding now that my brain, over the last year that's been engaged in storytelling and thinking about storytelling, I used to think about the sharing of ideas as marketing, that I'm trying to market ideas. And people, like, that worked for me, but it didn't really work for other people because they thought of marketing as Fifth Avenue and whatever. But as I've been changing my frame to telling a story,
right,
to combine the whole data
and what does it mean and what's happening and the facts and the story and how do you mix that? That's been more in my mind. And in my world, people are more and more talking about the story. And that was before this last month with this coronavirus and shelter at home explosion. Can you tell us briefly about your journey as a storyteller?
Well, sure. It started because in 1974, I believe, I was hired by Tim Holmes at the Cobleskill Public Library to be, you know, the person at the desk stamping out the books, which just was wonderful. As a kid, I loved the thought of stamping out books. Mm-hmm. I always loved libraries. Mm-hmm. So then he asked me, because I had a three-year-old, Jeremy, mm-hmm. to do the story hour because he knew nada about kids. He mm-hmm. was single. He was in his 20s. We were both in our 20s. And so I began reading books, but I went to some story hour instruction from the Mohawk Valley Library Association, and I took some workshops, and I met my great friend Janine Laverty, who's a wonderful storyteller. And when I began going to her workshops, that was it. Mm-hmm. I saw her telling stories at Minekill State Park on a mosquito-y night. Mm-hmm. She was very pregnant. I mean, this is decades ago, mm-hmm. and she was telling this amazing Irish story, and I thought, I can do this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never had thought I could act or do any public anything, mm-hmm. but it just gripped me. And so, you know, that was it. Once I began telling more and more and not reading books so much in the story hours.
Yes.
But telling them.
Telling them. And so then that was during the Vietnam, sort of towards the end of the Vietnam time, right?
Yes. It was getting toward the end. Yes. But, you know, there's been lots of wars since.
Yeah.
And then I began being, I'm a writer. I'm a poet.
Okay.
So I began doing writing in the schools. So the first thing that happened in the library was I applied for a 1976 America the Beautiful grant, Lady Bird Johnson, mm-hmm. and got cushions that they're still using in the library for the story hours with it. And so I got this idea, wow, you can get money to do the heart's work. Mm-hmm. So then I found a way to get funding through Poets and Writers and a local group upstate to do that mm-hmm. in schools and teaching kids to write poetry. I was sharing poems, but it was only when I began to tell a story at the beginning of the workshop mm-hmm. that I felt it. There was dough to knead. There were images in the story. There was ways to make meaning and vocabulary and a discussion of maybe a different culture like Iroquois or mm-hmm. whatever the teachers asked for. And I didn't have to say any things about that necessarily. It would get into the poems and
okay.
enrich them in ways, because you were always trying to get the kids to use descriptive language, speak mm-hmm. from their hearts, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So these stories help them do that.
Yeah.
So I realized the power of it.
Yes.
Especially for people to then, it went in so easily, and then they could give back so much more easily. I felt I was giving before I was getting, because as a teacher, you're often feeling like you're trying to get, you know?
Yeah. If I'm understanding that the poetry kind of opened their heart, and then out came the...
No,
the story opened their heart, and then the poetry.
Out came the poems.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
So when we ended up telling oral histories of the Vietnam War, I began to do more oral histories. You know, mm-hmm. so I ended up doing quite a few of those in middle and high schools, especially civil rights movement, Vietnam War. First, we did the Good War, three mm-hmm. of us, mm-hmm. which was about World War II. Mm-hmm. We would always have a poetry writing workshop after our performance as one of the workshops we offered.
Oh, okay.
Because again, you were trying to get people to digest what had happened, process, say, here's what it does for me. Here's what it pulls out of me. And so I thought of all that storytelling when you said, okay, let's maybe look at grief and trauma stuff.
Yes.
And storytelling. Because I guess I've always been really glued to trauma in human experience about what makes people harm each other, hate each other, kill each other. What are the paths to peace through what seems to be all kinds of, through our easy way to fall into fear and hatred.
Okay.
In the face of adversity and difficulty.
Yes. So telling the stories help people to look at that from less fear?
I believe so.
Yeah.
I believe so. I feel like there's no better way to learn history than through the stories of the individuals who lived it.
Yes.
Okay, yes. They're not doing jargon. They're not doing terminology. Right. Do you know what I mean?
And it's not like patriotism.
No.
It's
no, well, although there was plenty of patriotism, but it was how it expressed itself through their lives. So we each interviewed the two women and I did it, Janine Laverty and Becky Holder. We each interviewed two vets, at least, to say, we're three women. What do you think? Because this was 1992, you know, are you going to just, is that ridiculous? And they said, no. They said, no one's talking about it anymore. A middle school teacher who was friends with Becky said, my kids, the Civil War and the Vietnam War are equally remote. So we were trying to make it come alive.
Yeah.
And we then had to do it without obscenity, without drugs, without really black humor. Well, we managed it. When we did it for vets at the New York State Vietnam Veterans Memorial, we were trembling. My knees were knocking together. That's when I understood, oh, your knees do knock together when you're scared. Because we were each had our own bad fantasy of some guy standing up and saying, you got it all wrong. You're betraying us, you know.
Yeah. Right,
but no,
right.
It didn't half storytelling people were in that audience and half vets. And there were maybe 80 people there. I'm having trouble remembering. And what happened after was, first there was silence. We thought, oh my God.
Yeah.
And then vets came up to us and some were crying, you know, and oh God, we're thinking, what are we doing to them now? You know, and they began telling us their stories. They often would get mixed up about which one of us said, because it was like a collage of different voices for 45 minutes, you know, 50 minutes. Which one of us said what? They'd point to a different one of us to say, oh, that when you said that, this is what happened to me. And we realized, oh, man, it was ideal. We became invisible. The stories flowed through us. We could do that. Because I guess we felt so connected to the material.
Yeah, that's really profound.
It was amazing. It was of all the storytelling I did, the most profoundly gift to me, teaching me, you know.
Yeah.
How much we need stories. So many of them, you know, we were told things like, you lifted a burden that's been on me for 25 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, you only need one person coming up to you
to say that
to make the whole thing
worth it,
feel absolutely okay. Yeah.
Thinking about being the craft person.
Yeah.
So there's a number of my listeners that are fascinated with the craft of storytelling. There's a traditional, I guess, story arc.
Yes.
Sometimes I wonder, like, is that real? Like, can you say more about, like, when you guys were crafting, like, you did your research, you had this material. So then you had to put it together.
Yeah.
And, you know, good stories have tension, good stories, whatever.
Yes.
So how did you?
Well, you know, let me go back a little to what I was learning when I first began learning stories.
Okay.
And I was telling them to three-year-olds because I discovered the same deep, wonderful richness and meaning in those that are good for adults. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
And often I'd be in a time of crisis in my life. I told those preschool stories from the 70s to about 2005. Okay.
Wow.
In the library. Then yeah. Then I retired.
Yeah.
So I do 10 weeks in a row, fall and spring. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter what was going on in my life. My mother was dying at one point, you know.
Yeah.
Traumas were happening. I had to show up and be the story lady. And so the stuff I was learned at first was, number one, I read an article that I couldn't find. I was searching for it about some research on preschool kids and the stories they tell and recording all their stories and finding out what's in preschool kids' brains about the arc of a story.
Yes.
And they concluded that, number one, our brains are wired to understand things with the template of a story in mind. And stories, even like leaving nursery rhymes or row, row, row your boat gently down the stream, merrily, 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 life is but a dream, which was what I played on the recorder every time I ever did a story hour, and we'd sang it together. And because that has, it's a little eeny tiny kind of story, you know? Mm-hmm. There's a beginning. There's a journey.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reaching. There's often a call to some kind of action, some kind of entering the unknown, a tension, a conflict, who knows what, a search for the magic, whatever, all kinds of adventures. And then you achieve it or you don't, and you return a changed from entering the unknown and going through it, return. It's a circle, not necessarily to the original home, but to a home place, but often to the original home, transformed in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Joseph Campbell's stuff. And I'll send you the link.
Okay.
I just found of a whole, of someone teaching Joseph Campbell's The Journey of a Hero.
Mm-hmm.
That's The Journey of a Hero. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of refusing the call. There's all kinds of ways you play that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that operated. I haven't had a chance to think about how our program ended up. We were laboriously, we did it in time-wise, you know, beginning, getting inducted or drafted, basic training, first experiences when you show up. You know, we did it time-wise through the experience, getting home. But, and that had its own natural arc, right? And so, but I bet if I went back and looked at the pieces we picked for all of those stages, they would be that. And at the beginning, guy would say, we got off the plane and they were shooting at us. They didn't even know me. You know, what did I do to them? And they were shooting at us. So that was one kind of naivete. We would put in things we heard repeated. We read hundreds of oral histories, many books, that we heard repeated over and over again is how we decided who gets in. You know,
what you're saying is, yes, there is an arc. The arc is of a story is common, whether you're a child or an adult.
Yes.
It's how people's brains take in information.
And how they most readily remember stuff.
Okay. Say more about that.
If you've got stories to pin the hard facts, just the facts, ma'am, right, to, you remember them more. You remember them better. You understand why they are the facts because you've heard people's stories who were living those facts. Thank you.
What's interesting is, this is apropos of absolutely nothing, but maybe it is. But, you know, what I've been listening to lately is Cuomo, Governor Cuomo.
Me too.
And I think on so many levels, it's fascinating to listen to him, not just because he's clearly a leader. He's leading a state here. But he's also quite the storyteller.
Yes.
You know, I can see that whoever he or whoever writes for him, there is an arc to his stories and the way he's trying to communicate. And one of the things that I feel in this like crazy time, it's an overload. And I need so many different parts of myself to be engaged, but not too much.
Yes.
Otherwise, I just freak out.
Me too.
What he's doing is he goes from, so this is what I want to try to communicate. These are the facts as I know them. This is what it says to me. This is how I interpret it, which may or may not be correct. Then this is my opinion about it, which is my opinion. Then some inspiration so that we can keep going.
Right.
And I feel like it's very artful.
It is. And brilliant. Especially, I heard him driving and he was saying, this is on me. I know a lot of you are going to be suffering, losing job, work, losing pay. All this stuff is happening that's really hard.
Yeah.
Don't blame your local politicians, your county politicians. Put it on me. I take responsibility. I mean, I feel like that was so powerful.
So powerful.
For me to hear.
Yeah. Am I like reading that right? That he is telling a story each hour that he...
I don't hear him every day, okay? I tend to listen to the radio when I'm driving, and I've been driving less and less.
Yes, yes.
But I get an email every day with a summary of what he said, and I've been thinking I ought to go listen to him again.
Yeah. It's really powerful.
I know. People are talking about it. And again, I think he's finding the through line. There's a through line of what's the thing I want you to get really strongly?
Yeah.
What's the challenge we're facing? What do we have to summit in order to face it well? I mean, it is, and then he always ends the thing he sends us with a suggestion for a lightness. You can go for a tour of the orchids at the Botanical Garden in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. That was one, you know, you can sign up for that. Mm-hmm. A virtual tour. So there's always something at the end that...
So, you know, another thing listening to Cuomo is he has an acute sense of his audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that his audience is 90%, no, like 80% the state of New York, 10% the country, and 10% Trump.
That could be.
I made that up. But I'm saying?
I have very complicated feelings about him. And up till now, I didn't know that he was capable of this. I mean, he's risen way high in my estimation from former opinion. Let's put it that way.
Well, yeah. Myself in my work. So my consulting work, my podcasting work, my virtual groups, I think more and more about the audience and the message. What do I want people to come away with? I have this wealth of stories, like little stories. Like when I'm telling a story about expertise, or when I want to make a point about expertise, I tell the story about my grandson, Leon, who when he was six, he and his dad, Simon, were buried in dinosaurs. And they would read adult books about dinosaurs. And so one day I was kidding with him, with Leon, and I said, you know, your Aunt Kate is an herbivore. And he goes, oh, but she's not. She's an omnivore. He's six. And I said, no, but she's a vegetarian. And he said, Opa, she can eat meat. And I thought, okay, so that was expertise. He knew more than me. So he was the expert.
Right.
That's been such a useful little story to tell when I'm trying to make a point about expertise.
Right.
Back where I was saying that in my podcasting, I think about that I'm cobbling together little stories to tell a big story. Mm-hmm. So that is an example of a little story. I've never really thought about the story arc of that little Leon dinosaur story. It works great.
I know. You know what? Once you get that model into your head, mm-hmm. And because I told folk tales for so many years, and I was actually in college a comparative lit major. I started out English lit and I couldn't stand it. Mm. So I wanted more kinds of different stories from more places. So there's that arc in my life, you know. It's natural that I ended up telling stories from all over the world of all kinds, because mm-hmm. that's where my focus was. And so that models in you. And if you would read folk tales, mm-hmm. the common ones, mm-hmm. Cinderella tale, which is in many different cultures, I don't know how many hundreds of variants there mm-hmm. are. Or there's the youngest son going off on a quest. He's got older brothers also. They're messing him up. No one thinks he could do anything, but he's, of course, the one.
Yeah, Little Red Riding Hood, Hansel and Gretel.
Yes,
I mean, those are universal stories.
All of those. So that they start just showing up in your brain if you're immersed in story. Mm-hmm. So you end up not having to, I mean, you can, I think it feels mechanical to me to try to put that mm-hmm. in as you're developing the story. Yeah. It's helpful when you got more of it together to say, how does it look?
And with that's a good yes, yes.
And then is what I think with is wrong with it here or here because I'm somehow not, it needs that moment of climate. There's a turning point in a story,
yes.
right? And we used to have to get exercises from my friend Janine. Where's the turning point in your story? Where's the beginning? Where's mm-hmm. the challenge? Where's the turning point? Mm-hmm. Where's the resolution? Where did you start? Where did you end up?
I don't primarily know you as a, like, when I think of you, even though when I think storytelling, you're the vision that comes up in my brain.
Right.
But I actually think in my heart, what I think about you is that you're action oriented. You have a sense of social justice.
I do.
And you're.
Yes.
So that's the nut of what I think about you, and you do it as a storyteller.
Well, in retirement,
yes,
I did it as a storyteller. I was so happy. Mm-hmm. My work was my heart's work mm-hmm. for decades. And in retirement, I'm trying to make writing to be the same big picture thing. But mm-hmm. of course, it is always shoved to one side.
Yeah.
Always, always, always. I was thinking, well, what can I say about the, but I, it's a way of storytelling for me. Mm-hmm. And I recently put together a small collection of poems that I wrote in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It's called The Handbook of Suffering. Mm-hmm. I'll send you a copy.
Yes,
of,
please.
Okay? It's got maybe 9-10 poems. So I'll show you the, it's in this little ledger. Mm-hmm. I did it with my friend Paul Lamar, who used to teach English at the college here. Mm-hmm. And he's a writer. We both were commiserating mm-hmm. at a reading how we got all this writing and we're in our 70s mm-hmm. and what are we going to do with it? We'll just leave it unfinished. So then I finished it and I haven't looked at it for about 2-3 months because of the virus, because I went to California,
right.
you know, in February. And I opened up the notebook and here's a poem I stuck in there thinking possible last lesson. Because I thought it was done. I thought I had a last lesson.
Mm-hmm.
and I was blown away by it. I thought, you got to get back to writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I thank you, because I wouldn't have looked today. And what's in it, it's taking the story of Rebecca in Torah. Okay, a lot of my story poetry in recent years has been prayers, psalms, picking up stories from Torah and putting them into a poem.
Mm-hmm.
It's about Rebecca goes to the well to water her sheep, and she meets the messenger from Abraham who wants him to find a wife from his home place so that his son Jacob will not marry a Canaanite, an alien mm-hmm. group, okay? and she gave water to the messenger whose prayer had been, may I meet someone and may she do this, this, and this for me. And then she precisely does all those things. And so she gave him the water and then said, let me water your camels. And he had quite a few with him with gifts for a dowry for whoever he found. And she single-handedly, and she's either like, according to the Rebbe's in their Midrash, the stories that you add to Torah, mm-hmm. 13 or 3, okay? So, of course, she's the right person because she said, yes, please take some water and did that. And so I go through that story and the story of Akita, the Abraham being told to sacrifice Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah was never seen in Torah. She never appears with Abraham again. You just hear she died and she wasn't at home when she died.
Mm.
So the Midrash, you know, Torah is pretty, the story can be disjointed. It can have gaps. Okay. It's got white spaces, what they say. Mm-hmm. And Midrash fills in the white space with more stories. So it was sometimes said that she heard via Satan or via Isaac, depending on the story, what Abraham was about to do. And Satan said, he killed your son. And she emitted a shriek that shook the world and was the cry of the shofar that you hear on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. Okay? Mm-hmm. The ram's horn cry, because a ram was sacrificed by Abraham instead of Isaac when God said, or an angel said, don't touch your son. Okay? And so you take all that. This is like dysfunctional family. This is like soap opera. This is like mm-hmm. psychodrama.
Mm-hmm.
You can play it so many ways, those complex stories, which is one of the reasons I've been glued to Torah for a lot of years.
Mm-hmm.
I love those stories. And some of the Rebbe's say what Sarah was conveying to God with that shriek and dropping dead was, God, you went too far. There's such a thing as the limit to suffering. You can't do that to us. You can't push too far.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to go back and look at it. I don't know that God indicated that he heard that.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, I'll send you this poem too. Okay. I'm telling a story in this, and I have not found a public way. I haven't self-published this little book, The Handbook of Suffering. I haven't figured out what I'm going to do with it. But there's this great need for me to do those things.
Yeah.
It's an unfinished business feeling of I'm 76, you know. Yeah. And of course, this virus is saying, well, how much time do you think you have left, lady?
Yeah, right.
You could be dead in 3 days.
Yes.
Use a bridge during your telehealth visit with your primary care or family doc. Put the app next to your phone or computer, push the big pink button, and record the conversation. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. Check out the app at abridge.com, ABRIDGE.com, or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations.
Here are these, here we are as a community, as a nation, as a world.
Yeah.
Going through this apocalyptic time.
Yes.
How do you think people can use storytelling to help them navigate, not just navigate for themselves, but I guess really what I'm thinking about is, so I was on a call this morning with a friend of mine who was working very hard to stay calm for her kids. And while she was telling me about this staying calm for her kids, I'm thinking about all the work that that was taking for her to stay calm.
Right.
Whereas the world, and actually she's a storyteller. She teaches Mandarin, and she tells stories in Mandarin for young kids. And I'm thinking there must be a way to use storytelling so as not to have to work so hard to be calm in this not calm time.
Right.
I don't know that I'm making sense. But
you are. Can you help? Well, I always feel like there's some telling stories to your kids could contain some mirror. Stories are mirrors, you know, and often the characters are animals to make it a little easier that it's really about us always. And often they're kings and queens and princes and princesses, same deal. There's also stories that are, you know, plenty of them are about orphans and abused kids, lots of them. I mean, Cinderella.
Yes.
Look at that one. There's so those kinds of stories can help kids. I do feel like going to folk tales, going to fairy tales, going to some of the classic kinds of stories in children's literature will help kids. Will help you get calm as you read them to your kids or talk about them with your kids or help your kid calm down. You know, kids know their parents are scared.
Oh, totally.
They always know.
Yeah.
They know what's going on with us.
Right.
We can try to hide it.
Right.
But forget it.
Right. Right. I'm with you on that. This has been a rich day. I was on another call today, and I've been editing for a publication this week, conversation with my acupuncturist about Chinese medicine. I texted her yesterday and I said, I'm working on this and I need to talk to you about Chinese medicine and managing today, just like I'm talking to you about storytelling and managing today. And so she had some wonderful suggestions, but what she ended with was, you should come back to me when we're somewhat through this ordeal, because the PTSD that individuals and communities and states and countries are going to feel is huge, it's going to be huge. And Chinese medicine can help with that. Well, you started this conversation with the PTSD of the Vietnam Great War, whatever, you know, people. And so it seems like we're going to need this, not just today to find our way through this insanity, but also to recover.
Yes, and we always need it. We always need it. That's really it. And there can be the wrong kinds of stories that spread hate or judgment about groups or misinformation. And I just was listening this week. I listened to, I don't know if you know, the Krista Tippett and the Okay, so she was interviewing a woman, Rebecca Solnit, who's an a feminist, an economic, environmental sustainability activist. Mm-hmm. She's all kinds of, and she's written great books. So she wrote a book, I think, called Falling Together. And this was a 2016 interview, but Krista played it this week because we need it again. Yeah. And so I printed out from that some transcripts about we need good stories and we need better stories than we often get, especially from the media. All right.
Yeah.
And from experts and people who are analysts of what's going on. And she used what happened in Katrina in 2005. She went and interviewed people and heard their stories. So there's a whole lot of that in her book, I believe. And she says, I want better stories. I want more openness. I want better questions. All these things feel like they give us tools that are a little more commensurate with the amazing possibilities and the terrible realities that we face. And then that was pulled from the middle of the interview, and it was right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. She said, I'm really interested in what are the stories we tell and what are their consequences? And are there other ways of telling other stories that don't get told? And she goes on to talk about what were the stories that was told about the people of New Orleans, poor African-American, many of them, mixed race, many who were being accused of being horrendously violent to one another. And so they were all locked into the city and not provided a means of escape. You couldn't even walk over the bridge because the suburb on the other side, they were met with police cars and guns and made to go back and die. So that was the consequence at that time in our country, in that place. Mm-hmm. And she says, and then there were stories that we don't hear, Krista said, which were life-giving, and that in the immediate aftermath, more than 200,000 people invited the displaced strangers into their homes through a group called HurricaneHousing.org. So they're talking about all that. Mm-hmm. She says what really needs to happen is we have to start rejecting the canned narratives we're told. She doesn't say canned. She's referring to all the stuff that was not true at that time. And telling our own stories, becoming the storyteller, rather than the person who's told what to do. It's helping people realize it's their story that matters most. You know yourself.
Yeah.
You know your truth. Mm-hmm. And if you really tell that, if you really tell that without getting into the stereotypical language and memes of the current moment, you will reach a point of being able to connect to someone who you might think was very different from you. And there's media projects going on now. A woman named Eve Perlman, I'll try to look for them, where they've gotten together groups who are very different from one another in these Trump years.
Yeah.
To be talking to each other and getting to be friends. And they have managed it. And it's quite astonishing how they've changed how they think and feel about a lot of things. Yeah.
Well, this is great. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I hope this is what you
want. Oh, this is just fabulous. People are going to eat this up.
Well, I hope so.
Oh,
that's wonderful to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
The day my son died, we traveled from Albany to Buffalo. He died in his apartment shared with his girlfriend. We all gathered at his girlfriend's parents' house having traveled from all over the country. We spent a couple hours each recounting our stories from the past few days, trying to maintain chronology. I talked to Mike at 8:30. At 9, I was coming home from the grocery store. I got the call at 10:30. I got it at 10:45. We cried a lot. The past year had been difficult for everyone. We were exhausted and traumatized by the slow felling of this big, sweet 26-year-old man. We created a shared, detailed, uplifting emotional story. The world now spins at the beginning of a cataclysmic crisis. I see the fraying of nerves, the heightened anxiety, the fear, and the anger. It's all building. Let's connect and chronicle together. Listen to the stories our children, our family, and our virtual neighbors tell. Tell your story. As much as you can, meld the stories together. Share the tragedy. Share the silver linings. Honor the caregivers. Help the helpers. See the show notes, previous podcasts, and other resources on my website, www.health-hats.com/pod. Please subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. See you around the block.